Hi, and welcome to Navigating Life as We Know It,
a podcast series about celebrating ability, embracing diversity, and living inclusively. My name is Steve, and I am your host.
And I am Carrie, your co-host.
Today, our guest is Jennifer Knapp of Community Vision in Portland, Oregon.
Steve, how did you meet Jennifer?
I was attending a training session at the Center for Independent Futures in Evanston, Illinois, and she was one of the presenters.
And what impressed you about Jennifer that made you want to interview her for the podcast?
Jennifer's knowledge and experience in building a nonprofit, family-led organization from scratch. When you listen to her speak, you can tell she's an energetic and enthused person who believes very strongly in what she does. However, before we go on to the interview, I want to issue an apology to all the residents of Oregon. I mispronounced the name of their state several times in the interview, and when I went back to edit it, I realized it's impossible to edit that blunder out. Please accept my apology.
Great. Let's head on to the interview.
This is Navigating Life as We Know It, and I am your host, Steve Johnson. Our guest today is Jennifer Knapp, the Deputy Director at Community Vision in Portland, Oregon. Jennifer, welcome to Navigating Life as We Know It.
Thanks for having me.
Community Choices in Champaign-Urbana. I know that you were the executive director there once upon a time and one of the founding people involved with that. Could you give us a little background on how Community Choices came together and what you were attempting to do and what you have accomplished?
Of course. So Community Choices was founded in a college town, Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, which hopefully is familiar to at least some of the listeners. And at the time, so this was in 2008, was when we first started, there was only one other service provider option in Illinois, or in the town. They were a good provider, but they had very traditional options that worked for some people but didn't for others. And so Community Choices actually just started as a parent group. The family started coming together mostly to vent about their life situation and increasingly to start to plan for what could the future for their kids with disabilities be? And so after about 6 months of the families chatting together, the idea came that perhaps we could come together and actually form a support organization. And we had heard of this idea called Human Services Cooperatives, which we'll talk about a little bit more in the program. But there were some folks from Arizona, actually, who were teaching people about it. And so a couple of the parents and I went to a session, and we had one of those aha moments of, oh my, we could do this. We could offer an alternative that actually is driven by people with disabilities and their families and meet their needs. So we came back from that session all pumped and got to work on forming an organization. And so initially, the focus was continuing the family group, the kind of essentially had become a parent support group, and then starting to offer some social opportunities for folks with disabilities, for the kids. And that grew into actually offering some direct services. So over the time I was there, we went from this scrappy group of families talking to each other to actually having 85 members and offering three distinct services. So one service was community living. So we actually helped people to move into their own homes and apartments, sometimes a few folks together, other times people on their own. And we provided the coordination support and the skill development to make that happen. The second area we started offering was employment. So we helped folks with disabilities to get jobs. And then the third area was something that we called Connect. So we continued social opportunities and then also started to develop community connections with community members who didn't have disabilities. So we have, I tell some specific stories, but basically helping people with disabilities become embedded in their communities. So I was there for 8 years, and by the time I left, we had 8 employees and had really become a full-blown organization that was an alternative to the more traditional group home and sheltered workshop.
That is quite a bit of success there in 8 years. But I have a question. Yeah. Now, I know that I've become aware of the fact that the Medicaid programs in all 50 states can be significantly different from each other. And that in Illinois, which is my home state, I grew up in the Chicago area, that there really was not a great deal of service providers through Medicaid. And when kids get out of high school, they're kind of left to hang. And that probably created the need that Community Choices was filling. Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah, because so many of the folks that we supported, especially in the early years, had no Medicaid funding. So in Illinois, there were still about 20,000 people waiting for services. So they qualified, but there just wasn't enough money to fund everyone. And so there were many folks who were in that situation. They were on the waiting list. By families coming together and figuring out how we support each other, that gave people some hope. Through that time, then, some people would receive Medicaid services, kind of in ones and twos, but it also gave an alternative instead of just sitting around and waiting.
Now, when you say receive Medicaid services, would they receive funding or they actually have the services? I mean, did they have to find their own services?
Yeah, it was funding.
So they had the means to pay for it, but there really weren't too many service organizations in Illinois, right?
Well, yeah, so kind of both. So when I talk about the waiting list, that was actually waiting to get funding. So there's thousands of people who have no funding. But even for the folks who do have funding, as I mentioned, in our town, there was only one option. And they themselves had long waiting lists. So it's kind of a twofold problem. One was getting the funding, and then the second was actually getting services if you had the funding.
Isn't one option kind of an oxymoron? If you only have one to choose from, you don't have an option. So when you left, Community Choices is up to how many people?
So we had 85 people with disabilities and their families who were members by the time I left.
Okay.
And it started with a group of about 10 families.
That's a remarkable growth. And now you're in Portland, Oregon, where the coffee tastes better and the weather is a little bit nicer. I was amazed when I looked at the website for Community Vision, the programming, and the extent to which you really enhance people's lives. Could you tell us a little bit about the organization as a whole?
Yeah. So Community Vision is, I call it a little bit of a unicorn. we were founded out of an institution closure in Oregon. So kind of one person at a time, we were able to take folks I wasn't there at the time, but the organization took folks who had been living in an institution and helped them to either become a homeowner and actually move into their own home or to move into an apartment with as much support as they needed. So the model is called supported living. It's something that exists in some states and not in others. But essentially what it is a lot of states have some version of in-home support, and this supported living is that plus indirect coordination. By that I mean, so people with disabilities will get a certain amount of hours of direct support, and that happens in most states, either a dollar amount or an hour amount. With supported living, you get that, but in addition, you have this essentially 24-hour on-call opportunity. So we have people who we call supported living coordinators, and they have only 6 people that they work with. So they are, for a lot of folks, doing what parents had traditionally done. So they're doing coordinating staff and doctor's appointments and finances and kind of all of those things that need to happen for a person to be able to successfully live on their own. That's in addition to the direct one-on-one time. So that was really the foundation of our organization for about the first 25 years. And then in the last 7 or 8 years, we have really grown beyond just that initial service. So we have become really a wraparound option. So everything that we do is on an individualized basis. But in addition to that supported living service, we also have employment, so help people to get jobs. We have something really cool that I didn't know about till I moved to Oregon, and I'm not sure if it exists in Michigan or not, but something called individual development account. And so this is where the person can be saving towards a big goal, and it's protected. So Social Security doesn't affect your benefits, but it's something like towards starting a new business or purchasing a piece of assistive technology or purchasing a home, and then it's matched at a 3-to-1 rate. So for every dollar that the person saves, they get $3 in match. And so we operate that and do some financial education for folks to help them take some steps towards financial independence. And then the other program that we have, which is newer for us, is something called assistive technology. Probably a lot of the folks listening have heard of assistive technology, but we have a lab so people can come and try out different types of devices. We have a whole smart home set up in our technology lab where people can talk to Alexa and, and try out different types of technology. And but then the idea is to, again, build capacity. So we have all of these different options in our organization. In addition, about a year and a half ago, we completed a capital project called the Seven Corners Collaborative. And that's where we have actually now brought together seven nonprofits who all support folks with disabilities in different ways in one building. So we are here as Community Vision with all the services I just talked about. And then there's a parent organization, and there's a case management organization, and there's an advocacy organization, and there's a credit building organization, and there's a housing organization. So kind of the idea of a one-stop shop so that if you have a disability, kind of whatever age you are or whatever needs you have, you can come here and find the support that you need.
From a parent point of view, that is just awesome.
Yeah, it's been really exciting. And I think the other thing that's been cool is we actually have a coffee shop on the first floor. Again, as you mentioned, Portland is quite well known for coffee. so it's just one of the local coffee shops. But that's also, I mean, not only has this building become a place for folks with disabilities to come, have also been an avenue to connect with the broader community. Neighbors are coming and getting coffee, and then they're starting to get to know who we are and who we serve, and people are finding connections, and we're having summer parties, and we have actually on the fourth floor, we have a little roof deck, which makes us feel very fancy. But, you know, like the local business association is having events up on the roof. So not only is it this community connection opportunity for folks with disabilities and their families, but also for the neighborhood. And that has been really, really fun, because one of the things that we find is that community members are often unsure of how to interact with folks with disabilities, especially, I noticed this even more generationally, people haven't been exposed to folks with disabilities, they just don't quite know what to do. And so having these opportunities of where, like, yeah, it's cool, this is us, this is you, let's just chat. And being able to be embedded in this neighborhood has also been really wonderful.
Beneficial to both sides there. And I grew up in the generation that I never saw another student in high school or grade school in a wheelchair or in any way impaired. And I didn't even think those people existed because they were, quote, somewhere else, unquote. And it does make it difficult to relate. Now, being a parent, do see other people uncomfortable because they don't know how to talk with somebody in a wheelchair. I generally suggest they use English because that's a good way to start. But I mean, there is a barrier. There's a psychological barrier. And by normalizing the relationships and having people actually use the coffee shop, and I would assume that you have employees there with special needs working in the coffee shop, that's the other side of the mission. When someone does have support staff, are the support staff employees of Community Vision, or are they somebody you have helped them hire on their own through self-determination?
Good question. For our organization, they are Community Vision's employees. One of the things that is unique about supported living, as opposed to a lot of the in-home support, is again that expectations of people who are in the service are all living in their own homes or apartments. And so some of them have had family pass away. Other people have never had family. Other people still have family involved. But the idea is really the agency of Community Vision is taking on that responsibility. So how we do it is all of the direct support staff are our employees, but the individual is always involved in interviewing for people to work with them. So we have some folks, some staff who work with just one person, and that's their whole job. We have other people who work with several different people throughout the week, but each person has the opportunity to be part of the interview. Again, if they do have family in their life, family will be part of the interview as well. So it's a little bit of a blended model, but Community Vision has the responsibility for all of the employee paperwork or hiring, recruiting, you know, all of that, kind of that work part of it. But then we go involve the individual in choosing who actually works with them.
So Community Vision is a Medicaid provider?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and the specific service is called supported living. It's offered in some states and not in others.
Okay. Now, if someone is entering into a relationship with Community Vision for the first time and they have an individual they want to work with, that person could be licensed under your organization then?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had that several times that either individuals have recruited people specifically to come and work with them or brought people who were already working with them and just went through the hiring process to become our employees.
Well, that really gives them true choice, doesn't
it? Yeah, and one of the unique things that we offer with that is really helpful for some folks, again, we've got about 60 people that we support in this program, so it's not massive, but it is quite an undertaking, and some of those people have 24-hour support a day. And so one of the creative things that we have done is, especially for people who have higher support needs or who maybe were a little nervous about living on their own, we actually have an option where people can have one of our staff person as a roommate. There are some people who just have different staff, different shifts, but then there's others who have actually chosen someone to actually be their roommate. And so the roommate is our employee. It has a working agreement as opposed to a lease. So it's still the person's home. Because what we didn't want to do is have the employee have, you know, we wanted it to be the person's home in case the working relationship didn't work. We wanted Correct. The person to be able to not have them anymore. But it's really been a wonderful thing, especially for some of the people we support and frankly for some of the roommates. We have a man and his roommate who have lived together for 20 years. So for 20 years, this man's name is Tom. It's Tom's house. His family was able to actually help purchase it. And his roommate, Sean, has lived with him. And he's somebody who uses facilitated communication to speak. And so Sean has learned it. And Tom has other staff during the day. So Sean's not with him all the time. But he has that security of someone he knows and trusts during the night.
From what you're describing, I would imagine that your staff doesn't have a lot of turnover.
Yeah, I mean, we have about half of the staff who are very long-term. But just like any organization, sure. There's always people who come in and, you know, within the first, pretty much there's turnover within that first year or two. And then if people stay beyond that, then they're long-term. But, you know, just like any organization, there's always some people who think it's what they want to do and find out it's not.
True, but see, this is not one of the highest paying vocations that you can have. What keeps Sean there for 20 years is the quality of the relationship and the satisfaction with the job. That's a great formula.
Absolutely. Yeah, it becomes very much about Tom and his life as opposed to about Community Vision. And obviously, we try to be good to our employees too. But sure. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's those personal relationships are what make people want to stay.
Every state calls it something different, I guess. We call it a person-centered plan here, and it's proceeding from that. Is that how that works?
Yes. Yeah. So it's very similar. That is a federal requirement, the plan to happen every year. So for us, there's a layer of a case management at the county who helps with that annual plan. But yeah, we are very involved in it, and that's really what dictates the specific services for the year.
Do you have a lot of family involvement? Usually mom and dad, nationally, I think it's like 75% of the people living at home are over the age, or living with caregivers over the age of 65. But it's kind of hard for mom and dad to let go on occasion. We found that. Are they, are mamas and dads able to move on and rely upon this supported living program to care more for their child so they can go to Florida in the winter, or not in your case?
Absolutely. Arizona, maybe?
Yeah.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, for us, we kind of have two distinct groups of folks. As I mentioned, when we first started, most of the people that we were working with had been in the state institution. So for those folks, many of them either didn't have family or were already pre-disconnected from their family because they were living in the institution. That's a group of now they're getting older. Everyone is in their 60s and 70s. So people who have come on since then we have much more family involvement. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the big things is, of course, letting go and changing your relationship as a parent of an adult kid is super challenging. But I think one of the things that has helped give people peace of mind is this coordinator role that I refer to. Mm-hmm. So they are on call 24 hours a day, 5 days a week. And then there's one of them on call every weekend. And so that 24-hour availability, now that doesn't mean that they're physically with people 24 hours a day, but that commitment of being available is a key part of families being able to let go and trust.
So that really improves the quality of life for mom and dad too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And allows people to do things like, let's go on a vacation together and let's do fun things and shift the relationship so that it's supportive and more typical to their other adult children.
You know, over the last 20 years, I've worked in financial planning with families that have special needs. And when you ask them what's the most important thing that you want for your child, you get some typical answers, that some kind of security, to have a place where they can call their own. But the one answer that rises to the top over and over again is friendships, that relationships are the most important thing. And the greatest fear parents have is that nobody will really care for my child as much as I do when I'm gone. Now, the rewarding thing is to see those relationships and that caring support exist while you're still here. That, I think, is a great service that you provide, to be able to give parents that peace of mind that things are going to be okay.
Absolutely. And I think it's twofold, right? Not only is it the day-to-day care, but like you said, also the having healthy relationships. And I think that's one of the things that we continue to focus on, that recognizing that as professionals, as staff in people's lives, we can absolutely have good and healthy relationships, but we're still getting paid. Mm-hmm. And so part of our job as paid people is to help folks develop those connections outside of us. So yes, we are a critical part of their social life, but I think we do a disservice to people if we are the only part of their life. Again, that getting to know your people in your neighborhood and figuring out what you are interested in. So, for example, some of the fun things, we have people who are involved in dance classes. We have a woman who is older and is part of a program called Kids at Heart. So every Friday morning, she gets to go and hang out with preschool kids. We have folks that are part of a senior center and doing bingo. We have people who are doing gymnastics, you know, so all kinds of different things, finding those interests that people have and connecting them to other people who have that similar interest is a big part of what our role as staff is. So that, again, as you say, the parents can have a different kind of relationship, but also that we understand the limitations of our staff relationship with folks.
And when you talked about the housing initiative you have coming up, that was the Cathedral Park, Our Home?
Our Home Community Collaborative.
Huh? Right. That is going to be not exclusively people with disabilities, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know how much you all know about Portland, but housing prices have continued to go up. So in the past, you know, about 20 years ago, we were able to actually help people purchase their own homes. And there's quite a few pretty amazing stories from then. Currently, that is out of reach for a lot of folks. And there are some people who really want to be part of a community. And so Our Home is exactly this vision. It's something that's called co-housing. It was not something I was familiar with before coming here. I think Portland, Oregon might be the epicenter of co-housing, but it's essentially where people own a unit, but there's some communal space and some intentional opportunities for people to get together. So co-housing is not something that's focused on the disability world, but this project is exactly as you say. It's bringing folks with disabilities and other people together in this co-housing community. The purpose is that we will have about 20% of the units that will be highly subsidized for people with disabilities, and then the others will be purchased by community members, and we already have people signing up to do this. and that it will be truly a mixed community.
And the beauty of this is that the people that are neurotypical understand that they are buying into a co-housing situation with individuals that have disabilities. So there's no big surprises.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. That clarity and that honesty from the beginning is very important.
See, the word that comes to the front of my mind on that is sustainability. You have the forever home if that's their choice.
And I think it's really apparent. I mean, parents are forces of nature, right?
Make right.
things happen. So it's a parent who really is the energy behind this. And her vision is once this first one gets up and going, it's in a neighborhood of Portland called Cathedral Park. But the vision is once that is up and going, that the nonprofit, so she actually formed a formal nonprofit that then can work with people in other communities to develop similar projects. But the hope is that it goes beyond just this initial example.
Another important thing you got going with the Employment Connections Program. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So again, historically for our organization and many others, we focused first on housing, like helping people to live independently, but quickly realized that for many folks, having a part-time or full-time, depending on the person, job is often a first step, that maybe they, you know, have graduated from high school and are in their 20s, and that being able to have a job is a great confidence builder and a good first step, and frankly can have some income then for them to be successful when they move out. And so we work with similar funding as exists in other states. So we work with vocational rehabilitation and then the Medicaid long-term funding. And we go through a process called discovery. So that's where we just learn about the person and what they're good at and then develop jobs. And then we have job coaching for as long as it's needed. So some people, once they get a job, they're able to be fairly independent somewhat quickly. Other people need a person with them as long as they're employed. And so we can provide that as much support as is needed. And one of my favorite stories this is a true Portland story. We had a woman who doesn't speak much to communicate, but she indicated that the two things she was most interested in was coffee and bikes. And we were able to find her a job at a place called Bikes for Humanity that had a coffee shop and bike shop all in one.
What a perfect combination.
It was exactly. So her main role is doing bike maintenance. So she's cleaning bikes, and again, a job that doesn't require a lot of speaking. She knows what she's doing. And so anyway, that's a pretty fun one. But trying to really customize jobs to folks, because I mean, we all know that there's parts of our jobs we might not like, but the more that we can find a good fit, the better chance it is that people will actually want to keep working.
Well, that one's a great success story. So how many people have you got working through the Employment Connections Program?
Yeah, so currently there are about 25 people who are involved. And then we have, you know, some people who have discontinued our support because they're independent and good to on their job. And again, I have to be honest, there's some that don't work, right?
Sure.
We don't have 100% retention rate, but yeah, we do have quite a few folks that have been really successful.
The difference I have seen in individuals with disabilities that get jobs, it makes a big difference in their self-esteem. And when you have that
That's
kind
absolutely.
Of a boost, there's other things you can accomplish too that maybe you never thought you could, but you'll try because you were successful.
Right. And it's something, you know, you think about, especially here in the U.S., what's the first question you ask somebody is, what do you do?
Yeah.
And so many folks with disabilities don't have an answer to that. You know, so having that job gives them an answer to that significant question of how we start to build relationships with people.
Yep, gives them a connection. The next program you had is the Financial Empowerment Program. That's where you talk about these IDA accounts. Could you kind of go through that one more time? How does that work, your IDA?
Yeah, so one important thing on this to know is that these individual development accounts are not specific to disability.
Okay.
So we do it specifically for folks with disabilities, but the program is operated by the state of Oregon and it's focused on folks who are low income. So this is an example of where we have gotten creative and said, this is something that's available based on financial need. And we figured out how to make it work for folks with disabilities who definitely have the financial need, but also have some additional challenges. So that's just one caveat. As you're looking in Michigan, it wouldn't necessarily be under disability services. It might be more general. But again, in Illinois, this program didn't exist. So it's possible that it doesn't currently exist. So how it works is person has to prove that they're in financial need, and that is a set by the state. So here in Oregon, it's that they're at 80% of area median income. So they're below the poverty level. All of our folks have no problem, unfortunately, meeting that criteria. For our program in particular, then we also have the requirement that people have a disability, because that's our area of expertise. Again, in the state of Oregon, it's available to people who do not have disabilities, but our specific one is limited to that. And then what you do is you come into the program and basically have three commitments. The first commitment is that you have something big that you're saving for, an asset, if you will. So this is, as I mentioned, could be a home, could be a vehicle, could be a business, could be college, all kinds of, there's several different types of options, but you do have to pick a specific thing that you're saving for.
Okay.
And then you open an account, and it's a joint held account. This is a situation where the person is putting the money in, and then the match is being held separately. So part of why the person is able, why it doesn't affect benefits, is that the money from the savings and the match won't go to the person at the end. It will go to purchase something. Typically, people save from anywhere from 1 to 3 years. So part of the purpose is to teach people how to save and how to budget and work towards some bigger goals. So there's the second requirement is financial education. And so we, as Community Vision, have taken some curriculums that have been just available. There's something from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal government called Your Money, Your Goals. And we have adapted it to people with developmental disabilities. So a lot more interactive and simple concepts, but teaching that financial management. And again, different people understand that at different levels. And then the third component is how to take care of your assets. So if you're purchasing a home, what requirements do you need to think about to make that be successful? If you are starting a business, what's your business plan and how is it going to actually work? So that's kind of the three things: is you're saving, you're learning about finances, and then you're learning how to take care of your purchase. And then at the end, again, as I mentioned, for every dollar you save, you get $3 match. So most people will save up to $3,000, and then they will get a $9,000 match. And so it's a total of about $12,000 towards this big purchase.
That is a great incentive. And because they never actually have the money, it's not a countable asset.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And there's times that since we focus on folks with disabilities, we have a letter, because every once in a while Social Security says, what? I see this money. And so we have to send a letter saying, here's how this program works, here's why. And they always accept that. But they do have to continue to let them know that it is okay.
Right.
Right.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about microboards and cooperatives. So just hang on, and we'll be right back.
Insert mid-break here.
Welcome back. Our next topic is microboards and cooperatives. I just have a couple questions about how those work, but maybe you can just give us an idea what a microboard and a cooperative are.
Sure. So a microboard is essentially an organization created around supporting one individual with a disability. And so it can be formal, it can be an actual formal organization, or it can be informal, where it's a support circle around one person. A cooperative is when there are three or more people with disabilities that are connected with each other and are served together.
That could be three people living together, too. It doesn't have to be, but it could be three people living together.
Correct. Yep.
And my understanding that actually Community Choices in Champaign-Urbana was a cooperative?
Yes. Yes, it still is. And so some of the things that make it unique as a cooperative from other support organizations is that it's member-based. So people become members of the cooperative, and they have some say in terms of how the organization works. And then they also have some responsibility. So how we did it at Community Choices is there was a very small membership fee that could be waived. And then there was the requirement that everybody does two things for the cooperative throughout the year. And that those two things could be hosting a family party or coming in and helping lick envelopes at the office or, you know, all kinds of different things. But the idea of a cooperative is we're doing this together as opposed to the more traditional, we have staff that do everything.
Well, that sounds like a great way to get people involved. And for both of these, the idea is basically to form a circle of support. Most of all, you've got folks that are there because they choose to be there. So you have surrogate parents.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. There are benefits to this for both the individual with a disability and for family members. I mean, one of the things that families have certainly said to me is they were actually surprised at the people in their network, their response when they asked them to join the microboard or the cooperative. And that one thing just to clarify is that for microboards, it tends to be that the circle of support is other people in the community. And then with the cooperative, it's more kind of people supporting each other. So particularly in microboards, families were surprised that people were willing to say yes and willing to be part of the microboard and kind of realize that they had maybe done some self-isolation over the years where people were willing to be involved, they just didn't know how to. And so the microboard gave them a concrete way to be involved and be supportive and committed to the individual with a disability, kind of eased that pressure of wanting to be supportive and not knowing how to.
I think you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned about parents weren't able to ask because they felt it would be an imposition, because they know that these are the things that we have to do on a regular basis, but nobody else can do it or understands my child, and I don't want to inconvenience them, and it's kind of embarrassing, and so they just take the whole task on themselves. Whereas, like you said, people are willing to offer, but they've never been asked. If someone were to ask you, how would my life be different if I was part of a microboard or a cooperative from the standpoint of a person with a disability? How would you answer that?
So I would answer a little differently for the two because they end up looking pretty different. So for a microboard, I would say the answer is you have now people that you know you can call for whatever you need, that you have, you know, you have your people. And I think all of us feel like we have people maybe, but to have an explicit group of people that now you know and they meet on a regular basis and they're aware of what's happening in your life, it is truly building that sense of community. And you are not alone, or it's not just you and your parents anymore. It's you and these other folks who actually know and care about you. For the cooperative, again, because there are more people with disabilities and more families involved, again, it's a similar thing of you know that you have other people to count on, but it ends up being more of you have this built-in community and more activities to go to and people to get to know and all of that, because it tends to be, you know, these families working together. And one of just a fun story I have to share about the cooperative is, and this can happen in a variety of different parent groups, but one of the fun things for me, again, I was there as a staff person, but one of the cool things that happened is that families could challenge each other to believe in their kids in a way that I couldn't. So, you know, there'd be a parent saying, oh, my kid's struggling with this or can't do this. And other parents would be like, oh, actually, I have seen them do that successfully. Or how about you try this? And they could challenge each other. It was like positive peer pressure, you know, happened. It was in the cooperative, which is pretty cool.
And I think the other term that applies there is street cred. They have it because they're parents. They know. So what does it cost to join a microboard or create a cooperative?
Good question. So it depends on if you're going to do a formal organization or not. So if it's informal, particularly for a microboard, it doesn't have to cost anything. it's just the time, maybe some snacks for those first meetings. So there really isn't cost. If you're going to formally create an organization, then there is the paperwork any organization would need to file. So you have to file articles of incorporation. For a cooperative, you could choose to become a 501c3 nonprofit, and that costs some money. So the startup costs are fairly minimal. And again, then it's just going to depend on if you want to do formal services. And if you, again, like for us as Community Choices, as we started hiring staff and providing services, those had costs. But the actual startup was, I think it was in the range of $1,000 to $2,000. I mean, that actually getting started doesn't cost a lot. It really depends on the services.
But if you actually want to hire services and get Medicaid to pay for it, you have to be incorporated and be a 501c3. Is that correct?
So you don't actually have to be a 501c3 to get government funding. You do have to be incorporated, but you don't have to be a 501c3. You do have to be a 501c3 to get most grants, most like foundation grants.
If someone listening wants to find out more about micro boards and cooperatives and how that might benefit them, where would they look?
Well, I think one great resource is actually one that you have found too, Steve. And so that's the Illinois Association of Micro Boards and Cooperatives. It is based in Illinois, but it has great information about how micro boards and cooperatives work anywhere. And that is, would you be willing to share that website? I don't have it.
I certainly will. That'll be on our website.
Okay, perfect. So that's probably a great place to start to get information.
I did want to focus in again on the Seven Corners Collaborative. I think that's a wonderful thing that you guys have done. I certainly could see many other communities would like to have something similar to that, where you have six nonprofits, each providing services to people with disabilities in one location under one roof. The synergy that's possible there is amazing. I understand there's also an art gallery that displays work of artists there. Do they actually have a gallery where they're working or just displaying?
Good question. So this is just display. We haven't talked about the lot, but the county actually donated the land to us because it's this weird triangle piece of land. And so that's how the Seven Corners comes, is actually because of the intersection. But we had this little extra space. One of the things that we did when building this building is use universal design principles. So essentially we took the American with Disabilities Act standards, the ADA, and said, what if this was really built for everyone? So we have all kinds of cool accessibility features. And to do that, we had to do things like make wider stairs and for the exits. And so we had this little extra space that we didn't know what to do with. And we created essentially, you know, like how if you go to Macy's and they have those display windows, the gallery is like that. So it's actually street facing, and we display the artist's work, and it's all lit up at night, more like a display. And then what we do is we have quarterly, we change the artist that is in there and it's featured, give them a stipend. And then we do an art opening. So we have people come and the artist is there and there's art that happens together in those openings, but that is more sporadic than the display happens throughout the year.
How many artists do you have?
We are doing one a quarter. So there's a whole process where people can apply and then they get a stipend if they're selected. And then each quarter we feature a new artist.
That gives them a great opportunity to show their stuff, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And we've had, you know, people just, again, talking about community involvement, people come in from the street and say, hey, is any of that art for sale? And we'll be like, yes, it is. So that the people have sold some of their pieces that way. I think that we really covered it. I think it's just basically the idea that it really is possible to give people individualized services and help them create a real community. And we have done it here and want to keep helping people do it all over the place.
And it sounds to me like when it comes to cooperatives and micro boards that you actually have embedded that into your entire program, because everything you do is empowering individuals and providing the appropriate amount of supports, not overbearing, but just the appropriate amount of supports for them to truly live as independently as possible. My last question for you, because I see you as a caring person who really has a passion for your work. And knowing what we have right now in the year 2020, in terms of supports for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, what world would you like to see greet a child born with a developmental disability in the year 2040? If you could get into a time machine and go forward 20 years, how do you want to see that child treated by the world?
Wow, what a great question. I think that the biggest thing is that I would like to believe that disability no longer is a barrier, that people are so fully interconnected in their communities that it's just one of the things, just like many of the other ways that we're diverse as humans, and that there's truly inclusion and accessibility that people can get around, and they are seen as being part of the society around them as opposed to separate.
I think that's a beautiful answer. My second question, there's always two. What do we have to do to make that world a reality?
Also good. There's many things, but I think two big ones. One is that we in the disability community have to get better at helping folks to explore. So again, as we talked about generationally, I think this keeps shifting, that we're exposed to people with disabilities and that we're seeing folks more and more. But I think as families, as service providers, we have to really push that inclusion support as opposed to having our own little kingdom. In addition, I think there is an education piece for the community. Again, as we talked about earlier, there's a lot of folks who would be happy to interact with people, but don't quite know how to. And I think being intentional about finding those community partners who want to interact and helping to teach them, then they become ambassadors for us to get to this beautiful vision. So I think it's twofold. It's being intentional kind of from within the community to start looking out, and then also educating folks who are part of the general society of how to interact and include.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, well, best of luck in the future, and we'll hope to see you again sometime soon.
Hi, this is Kiri, and this is the NLOCKY Chat Cafe portion of our podcast. And this is where Steve and I kind of discuss some of the things that went on in the interview. So here's Steve, and we're going to get right to it. This woman has quite a bit of energy, and you kind of wanted to expound on something. Go ahead.
I think what's amazing about her story is that she starts out in Illinois with no services, no funding for people with disabilities. And just some parents that are dissatisfied with this, and they get together to kind of grumble maybe in a little bit, but then they start planning.
To figure out how to make this different.
How can we make life better for our kids? Parents are a force of nature. It's fun what they did because they just started building. They became a Medicaid provider eventually and expand services, support housing, find work. They did a lot of things to help create that life.
Right.
So it's a family-led initiative. It was something that was started by parents. But it wasn't just parents' wishes being imposed on their kids.
Right. And then she takes that energy and moves to Portland.
She went from community choices, which literally was community choice, and then went to community vision, where, oddly enough, the vision word, it's expanded because of what they do there is even more than what they were able to do in Illinois.
Right. And wow.
I mean, I'm really impressed with, I want to go out there and visit. I want to see Cathedral Park. I want to see their co-housing and the different
things. The
Seven Corners Initiative. I mean, can you imagine one-stop shop?
Well, and then the lab and be able to go in there and see how these smart things would actually work, because you think, well, that might work, but maybe it really doesn't. And so, wouldn't it be nice to have a place to go to trial it. Oh.
Now, the beauty of it is, and again, with Jennifer's enthusiasm, her knowledge, her positive attitude, this could be built in many different locations, not just Portland, Oregon. And it might be different, but the philosophy behind it, talking to builders, developers, disability housers, what would co-housing look like in Grand Rapids? What would it look like in Chicago or Alabama or any place else?
Right.
What could happen? And that's kind of what they're doing at the Kelsey
in San Francisco.
Right. Right. So again, this is all doable stuff.
There's limitless possibilities.
Okay. Then the other thing that she brought up was the individual development accounts.
Correct.
And you did some investigating into that, and that is something that is available here in Michigan.
Yes, it is.
And that's called the same thing?
It's individual, IDAs.
Okay.
They're the same thing, same deal. Your person with a disability saves a dollar for a predetermined and approved purpose, and it's matched $3 to the one that they save.
That is phenomenal.
And it doesn't count against them in terms of countable assets for Medicaid eligibility.
I wonder how many parents knew about that before.
Virtually
this.
None.
Ah.
Virtually none.
But now we have another tool in our toolbox.
Yes, we do.
Yay!
Yep.
Kind of the wrap up was her description of micro boards and cooperatives. I thought that was very interesting. And we are most assuredly going to put that, the website she referred to.
That's the Illinois Association of Micro Boards and Cooperatives.
Right. Excellent resource. Again, another tool.
And if you have any questions about today's episode or any previous episode, you can go onto our Facebook page, ask the questions, make the comments, or simply email us at contact@nlawky.com. That's contact at nlawki.com. And we promise to get back to you right away.
Again, many people are needed to do these things, just as many people are needed to put on a podcast.
And I want to thank you for being my inspiration and my help.
And the person to make you stop sometimes before you wreck it.
Right. Yeah. The one that reins me in sometimes.
Yep. We also want to say thank you to Alexander,
who is our engineer and producer and does a lot of things behind the scenes.
Then we have Holly.
She makes our website look very, very professional and function very professionally also.
Indeed. Daniela is our intern and does our post-podcast interactions, among other things. And then always, you, our listeners, thank you so much for joining us. And we hope that you are able to pick up these tools and put them in your toolbox, and that they will make navigating life as you know it easier.
Navigating Life as We Know It is a production of Envision Media Group, LLC. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.